Hello and welcome to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York, on the ancestral and unceded homelands of the Mohican people, known today as Stockbridge Munsee Community. I'm Lennox Aputo.
And I'm Bria Barthel. Today on the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, we start with Mark Dunley's report from a forum sponsored by the Justice Center of Rensselaer County, with comments about the efforts of Lights Out Norlite to permanently close the Norlite plant. Then we hear from Paul Stewart, the co-founder of Albany's Underground Railroad Education Center, as he talked with me about a new interpretive center being started with a groundbreaking ceremony on April 22nd and so many other planned events. Later on, Hugh Johnson joins us to reflect on the solar eclipse that happened on April 8th, as well as the shifting effects of El Nino, and of course, his weather forecast for the week. After that, our roaming labor correspondent, Willie Terry, brings us another segment of his coverage of the March 2024 SOMOS, New York State Conference of the New York State Assembly and Senate, Puerto Rican and Hispanic Task Force. Finally, Marsha Lazarus interviews Dr. Alice Payton Green to talk about her second memoir, Outsider, at the Writers Institute at Albany Public Library. But first, a few headlines.
The Gazette reports that 2 weeks after the unveiling of a proposed budget that would have increased property taxes by more than 9% for the upcoming fiscal year, Scotia lawmakers on Monday are expected to finalize a budget that would reduce that tax burden through increased use of reserve funds and minor spending cuts.
The City of Troy's spring cleanup begins on April 15th. Operation Refresh will have multiple dates for free bulk trash drop-off, as well as deep cleaning of alleyways and streets and rejuvenation of city parks. The Alamo will be open for bulk item disposal on April 20th, May 4th, and May 11th.
State police and Saratoga County prosecutors are being sued for allegedly covering up a former trooper's sex abuse of boys. Roger Kuhn Jr. abused children for 4 decades, including after he retired, despite credible accusations against him.
The Times Union reported on Monday that New York City's Touro University is exploring a possible partnership with the College of St. Rose that may help keep the Albany's Pine Hills College campus open in some form.
As everyone knows, April 15th is the due date for filing income tax returns in New York, though a couple states have the date extended to April 16th. If you did not file your tax return yet, consider going to irs.gov to apply for an extension.
And let's end on a sweet note. Ben and Jerry's annual free ice cream cone day will be on Tuesday, April 16th. And that's it for our headlines.
For those of you just tuning in, you're listening to Hudson Mohawk Magazine, listener-supported radio that builds community in Troy and the surrounding capital region through broad grassroots participation.
Our content is produced by volunteers. To learn how you can join our team or contribute your financial support, see the donate button at mediasanctuary.org. Email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org or call us at 518-272-2390. We welcome your suggestions for segment topics, too.
Now to our first story. Mark Dunley brings us a report on the efforts of Lights Out Norlite's work to have the plant permanently closed and have the owners responsible for properly disposing of its hazardous waste ash.
The Justice Center of Rensselaer County held a forum on environmental justice on Sunday, April 14th in Rensselaer. In this segment, we hear from Joe Ritchie and Dave Pablo of Lights Out Norlite. The Norlite hazardous waste incinerator and aggregate production facility in Cohoes, after years of controversy over its air pollution, recently announced that it was temporarily closing. Norlite is being sued for being a public nuisance by the State Attorney General and DEC, as well as by Lights Out Norlite. The group discusses a proposed county law to make the plant comply with changes in federal and state laws that now require them to properly dispose their hazardous waste ash rather than selling it as a building project. The speakers also expressed their opposition to DEC Chief of Staff Sean Mehar becoming the DEC Commissioner to replace Basil Sagos based on his performance with Norlight.
Thanks to Noreen for inviting me, and such a pleasure to be with everyone today, especially talking about Lights Out Norlight and the fight that we have to do to close this facility permanently and not just temporarily. Clap! It's a big thing! Really, we couldn't have gotten this temporary closure without grassroots activism and support like from organizations like this and coalitions that are going to be standing up here today. I'm Joe Ritchie, lifelong Cohosier. I've lived for approximately 21 years at the Saratoga Sites Public Housing Development, which is literally a stone's throw away from the Norlight Hazardous Waste Incinerator. I'd be playing as a kid, and I would see dust plumes coming from the fence line from the Norlight facility that we would later learn to be hazardous silica dust that kids are playing in. Fast forward to today, I found out about Lights Out Norlight through Sanctuary for Independent Media that kind of reeled me in on this issue. Because in about, it was 2019, 2020, when we learned about the AFFF incineration, and that's the hazardous PFAS chemicals that Norlight was illegally incinerating millions upon millions of pounds that the DEC knowingly let them do. When I found that out, I was outraged, have been leading the way to get this facility shut down so we can have justice for those at Saratoga sites who are no longer there, because through grassroots organizing, we were able to close the Saratoga Sites public housing development and relocate folks to safer housing so they don't have to raise their children in these dust piles, in these areas where they're playing with black snow and their hands are getting dirty. I think this is a first in the nation that a public housing development has been moved because of the environmental danger living next to a facility like Norlight presents. Something that's really exciting that's happened within the last week, the Albany County legislator has introduced a bill, Local Law E, that would prohibit the mixture of Norlight's fly ash into their aggregate material. In layman's terms, they essentially have this waste ash that they get from their production, and they've been mixing it with the material that they sell to the public that is able to construct buildings all across the country. This material can have hazardous materials like mercury and all heavy metals, PFAS even, maybe back when they were incinerating the PFAS. So we're really trying to get them to stop selling this material and combining it. You don't want that in your pool. I found out one of my buildings at Syracuse University actually was built with Norlight aggregate. We have to make sure that they can no longer do this because it's hazardous to us just living there with the piles so high. They're bigger than any building in Cohoes and blowing on us. Norlight not only have impacts in Cohoes, but the entire globe, because this stuff is going everywhere. And we need work from the community to get this type of law passed at the Albany County legislature. We've been able to do it before with the PFAS fight. We've been able to pass national leading laws in the PFAS to ban incineration of PFAS and at the state level, at the county level, and at the city level. And we're looking to do this now at the county level because we have great supporters with County Legislator Mert Simpson and County Legislator Bill Reinhart. So we're really excited for their help, but we need each and every single one of you to call a county legislator and say, we need you to pass Local Law E. While Norlight's temporarily closed, we need to give them the finishing blow. I also consider myself a pacifist, but when it comes to Norlight hurting my community for decades, I'll make an exception. It's been such a pleasure working with people like Judith Enck, who have been such a role model for me with environmental activism, people like Dave Pablo. They've taught me a lot because being a resident next to this type of facility for 20 years, when you start to learn all of this information, you get a little scared for yourself. But they've always kind of focused me back in, really made me think about the broader impacts of the community. I hope to live a long life. I really do. I'm scared. I'm genuinely scared what the impacts of living next to Norlight could do to my health. But I don't want another Joe Ritchie playing in the fields of Saratoga Sites or in Cohoes to experience a Norlight facility anymore. We can stop this. And we are almost there with a temporary closure. And when you're an advocate, don't be afraid to tell your local elected officials what you feel. because they need to hear it. They need to hear it from you, because for decades, we were always told that what we're experiencing, the dust on our cars, the smells, it's coming from 787, the highway. You don't have to worry about it. The black snow that we played in, you don't have to worry about it. That's coming from the truck. Well, guess what? One night I went out, I said, you know, I've had enough. And I tested, I sent the dust, I scraped it off with a playing card, I think. I sent a picture to our group at Lights Out Norlight. And I said, does this look normal? This happened overnight. My car was enveloped in dust. It looked yellow, greenish. It was really a scary thought because I just washed the car. Dr. Dave Walker, who is a world-renowned professor in Columbia University, said, that dust looks awfully familiar. I sent it down to him. He tested it. He said, that looks like volcanic ash. You don't have those in Cahoz. No volcanoes in Cahoz except the Norlight volcano. Really, when the alarm bell started to fire off in my head. And really, through activists, we were able to prove the local elected officials who have for decades downplayed the situation at Saratoga sites in Cahoz that there was nothing wrong. Guess what? There was. The DEC knew about it the entire time. So we've said enough's enough. We're going to shut the lights out on Norlight because we've had enough. Our neighbors are getting displaced. Our mothers, our brothers, our family members, our neighbors, all getting impacted by this facility. And that's why we formed the organization Lights Out Norlight to officially turn the lights off on this damn facility and say goodbye.
My name's Dave Pablo. I wanted to make a remark about one of the things that keeps coming up, and that is the DEC. The DEC is basically run as a political entity. Over the last 4 years, being highly invested in the Norlight situation, I've seen behavior patterns from them that are just really hard to stomach. Yes, there are some good people at the DEC, of course, but there are too many, especially I think in higher positions, who behave in a manner that's just not acceptable. And I want to give you one example. This is very recent. You know, one of the things that's happening with Norlight is, of course, this dust is flying off in all directions, and it has two basic hazardous parts to it. One is the silicate that was mentioned by Joe, and the other one is essentially that the baghouse dust, which is the pollution control system dust, is hazardous waste that's been burned, gone through their system, and then it's collected, right? And that should be disposed of as hazardous waste, but Norlight has had this exemption for years and years. They've turned it into a product. They have it in giant piles. They blow every which way. The DEC in the last year and a half has been using remote sensors and using air quality index measurements to decide whether something is good or bad, and that is inherently problematic. But on July 24th, this past summer, there was a kind of a breakdown in Norlight's process, and this baghouse dust that they were supposed to be keeping in airtight silos, they instead directed it out, and it was basically plopping out into the open air. The sensors from DEC were going off the charts, and how did the DEC handle this? Well, they didn't warn anybody. They didn't notify anybody. And then on January 25th of this year, they issued a notice of violation to Norlight about this behavior and other things. And so that 6 month delay is not enforcement, of course, it's enablement. And that's a consistent pattern coming from the DEC. And it's what we need to have changed, I think, fundamentally.
And I think, I can't remember if Dave coined this term or someone else, but I really, unfortunately, there are a lot of good people in the DEC, but the people who are leading the charge simply do not care about our interests. And I've been told the DEC stands for doesn't even care.
This has been Mark Dunley for Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
We just heard from Joe Ritchie and Dave Pablo of Lights Out Norlight speaking at the March 14th forum sponsored by the Justice Center of Rensselaer County. For our extensive earlier coverage of the environmental challenges posed by the Norlight plant and Lights Out Norlight's efforts, visit mediasanctuary.org.
Next, my co-host Breer Bartel brings us this update on the many activities happening at the Underground Railroad Education Center, including an upcoming event celebrating the groundbreaking for its new interpretive center.
As most listeners know, Arbor Hill is an under-resourced area in Albany, but there's an exciting new project coming in. And I'm here to talk with one of these people spearheading the project. Paul Stewart is a co-founder, or in his words, co-instigator, of the Underground Railroad Education Center. Paul, welcome back to Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
Thank you, Bria. It's a pleasure to be here.
And currently, the Underground Railroad Education Center, I may call it URIC from now on, just so that my tongue doesn't have to work so hard, is housed in a 19th century former residence of African-American abolitionists Stephen and Harriet Myers. This location is documented as having helped many people escape the institution of slavery through participation in the Underground Railroad. But there's another building that is going to be brand new with some history behind it, but state-of-the-art technology. So, Paul, what's going on with this new interpretive center?
Yes, so we're building an interpretive center, which will be a facility to help us tell the story of Stephen and Harriet Myers and the broader story of the Underground Railroad and the legacy of the Underground Railroad in Albany and beyond. And we'll be building that building just a couple of lots away from where the Stephen and Harriet Myers residence is, a couple of lots east of the Myers residence. And it's going to be on land that's already vacant that the Underground Railroad Education Center has purchased in prior years. And we've assembling these parcels together. And we're going to build a building on there, the 13,000 square foot building. It's going to have a 5,300 square foot footprint, but there'll be three floors, so it'll be 13,000 square feet. And the building is a $9.7 million project, so that's practically $10 million. It will be housing a lot of facilities that will help us to be able to tell the story of Stephen and Harriet Myers and the people that they worked with and the larger story in a more effective way.
Now, you have a model of the building, and at a previous open house, people were looking at the model. People who were not frequent visitors at Stephen and Harriet Myers' residence were impressed by exhibit space and performance space and office space. Those of us who have volunteered here frequently were most impressed that you're going to have bathrooms. Tell us about the current facilities here at Stephen and Harriet Myers.
Yeah, so one of the things that we have done for many years is there was some, I want to say, lack of clarity about how much and how there was water in the building in the 19th century. Stephen and Harriet did have an outhouse. And so one of the things that we've done to address that for our current needs is to have what we call our outhouse moderne, which is a port-a-john. It's a high-end port-a-john. It's wheelchair accessible. It's kind of spacious for if you're familiar with port-a-johns. And it also has a hand-washing station, and we put some flowers in there. So it's got the hand bars for handicap use, and it's on a cement pad. So it's a very accessible space, but some people would prefer to have a conventional bathroom, and we will have that in the new center.
I understand there's going to be more to the facilities. We're moving from 19th century technology to 21st century technology. What else is going on with the new interpretive center?
Yes, I'm glad you brought it up in quite that way. The building is going to be a net zero building, which means that we're going to have a high performance envelope, building envelope. We're going to have solar power. We're going to have a geothermal heating and cooling. We're going to have a number of features in terms of lighting that are kind of cutting edge. And I think people will enjoy the combination of some of these modern technological features together with the 18th century Dutch barn frame that we're going to be using as the internal framework of the main assembly hall. So we are using a Dutch barn. We've already purchased it and moved it from Fort Plain to a workshop in Altamont, and it's going to be put up as part of the internal framing of the assembly hall.
And now when you talk about the assembly hall and moving the barn structure, there's an event coming up of the groundbreaking. Let's hear about that.
Right. So we're going to have our groundbreaking kickoff on the 22nd of April. That's Earth Day. And that's very appropriate that it's Earth Day because the building is a net zero building, very environmentally sound building. The building is actually, we're trying to build it to what's called Living Building Challenge standards, which is a certification similar to LEED certified, except environmentally related. And it's just going to be an exciting building. There's going to be so many features in it that I think people are going to be engaged by as they interact with them. So, yeah.
And besides the building and the excitement of having all that space, in a separate segment, I talked with Lacey Wilson, who's designing a new teen program in museum studies to introduce the next generation of historians, potential historians. How do you see that program relating to the Interpretive Center?
Well, that's going to be one of the programs that we're going to be developing in the Interpretive Center. And also, I didn't mention, but I certainly wanted to mention that the very first thing that we're going to be able to do at the Interpretive Center is we're going to have an exhibit when the Interpretive Center opens in the fall, more or less the fall of 2025. We're going to have an exhibit from the Smithsonian Institution called Voices and Votes. And we are one of 12 different museums that will be hosting that exhibit as it goes around the state of New York. So we're the 12th in the series. We'll have the building up and ready when the exhibit is on its way to us.
Is that the old trick of the best way to get something done is to have a tight deadline?
I'm sure. Yeah.
Okay. And meanwhile, even though you are in a residence that is still being reconstructed, you have a lot of other activities going on besides the Interpretive Center, because that just isn't enough to keep you busy. What are some of the other activities that happen through the Underground Railroad Education Center?
Well, throughout the year, we have a lot of different things going on. Quite commonly, what we do is we have what we call a tour experience at the Myers residence. So people who are interested in coming to see the Myers residence, to be able to sit in the space and in the place where the Vigilance Committee of the Underground Railroad met and where Stephen and Harriet Myers conducted their daily lives and also interviewed freedom seekers and provided food, clothing, shelter, and transportation assistance to people who were seeking freedom. That's one opportunity that people have. We do these tours pretty frequently, so if people are interested, they should call us up and we can schedule a tour. They can call us at 518-621-7793 and we will schedule a time when they can come for a tour. We also have UREC Reads, which is our book discussion, which we do on the second Friday of each month. We do it right here in the Myers residence in the front parlor. We are doing it as a hybrid program, that is to say partially Zoom. So we do have some people that Zoom in to the program as well. We have a Girl Scout troop that meets here. They meet during the course of the month. We also have a number of other programs. We have some arts programs that are happening on Fridays. We have our Freedom Con 2024 that we are doing right now. So on the third Saturday of the month, we have a Freedom Con program, and that's a Zoom presentation too. So if people want to know about that, they can go to our website, undergroundrailroadhistory.org, where they can see information about the Freedom Con program and also sign up for it if they would like to do that.
And then with summer coming, you also have a garden.
Yes, the summer we have a garden that we do, the Abram Johnson Garden, and we do have some volunteer gardeners that have been working very, very hard there to make it a truly beautiful space. We also have our summer program, our Young Abolitionist Leadership Institute, which actually runs throughout the full year. It's a teen-focused program. During the school year, the teens at Albany High meet for sessions. And then also during the summer, we have a 5-week segment that is tied into the to the summer youth employment program, so that kids can actually be here as a work site and get paid while they learn a little bit and do and contribute to helping us keep the various things of the Myers residence in process.
And that was Paul Stewart from Underground Railroad Education Center. This is Bria Barthel for Hudson Mohawk Magazine. Paul, I need to go take a nap because I'm exhausted just hearing everything you're doing. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Bria.
Among the many other things, Albany's Underground Railroad Education Center focuses on framing the historic activities as a nationwide civil disobedience activism, a somewhat different take from the usual portrayal of the efforts.
For those just tuning in, I'm Lennox Aputo.
And I'm Bria Barthel. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network, WOOC LP 105.3 FM Troy, WOOG LP 92.7 FM Troy, WOOS LP 98.9 FM Schenectady, WOOA LP 106.9 FM Albany, WCAA LP 107.3 FM Albany, and streaming online at mediasanctuary.org. This program comes from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York.
If you like what you hear, you can support this program by sharing our content with friends, acquaintances, and others. Find today's stories, full episodes, and more at mediasanctuary.org.
Now we get our weekly weather update and discussion of all things climate-related with retired National Weather Service meteorologist Hugh Johnson. Last week, we ran a special program about the solar eclipse, so welcome back, Hugh.
Hey, how's it going, Bria?
Good. Where did you go to see the eclipse, and what did you experience?
Well, my wife and I went to Rochester. We planned that months and months in advance, and unfortunately, we did not score. We happened to be one of the places that had clouds during the eclipse. And, you know, it was funny. On Sunday, I saw the handwriting on the wall that if you went from the thruway, or rather the northway east, it would be much clearer, and we would be really iffy in and out of clouds. Now, some people did see it to the west and east of Rochester, as close by as like Syracuse, and I think a few people saw it on Niagara. But I could see what was happening on the satellite pictures. The clouds were actually thickening right as the unfortunately the eclipse was getting underway. So we did not see it, but what we did see, and we cannot be taken away, was the darkness. It got amazingly dark because there was no sunlight or there was no photosynthesis or anything. It got just as dark as night. It came on very quickly. My wife is saying 10 minutes before, it's not so bad. I said, oh, you haven't seen anything yet. We looked over to the west and there was the wall of darkness coming at us. And yeah, it got very dark. And then also what really blew me away was what happened next. I guess as the sunlight was starting to, the lighter clouds were starting to come our way, the sky, it was like someone smeared the sky with blood. It was carmine red, and it looked like something out of the Bible. It looked really frightening. I wonder if this is what it looked like when the comet hit 65 million years ago. I don't know. But that perhaps was the most interesting part of the whole eclipse, that all of a sudden had this reddish tinge in the sky, and then you could see the light coming from the southwest, and within moments it was all over. Now, the other thing that was interesting was there was a thermometer next to the hotel I was at, and the temperature, are you ready for this? It only dropped 3 degrees. It went from 62 to 59. And the reason why I don't think it dropped more than that is because we had the thick clouds. It prevented radiational cooling that you would get during a normal eclipse passage. In fact, we grabbed our jackets and 15 minutes before the total, like I'm the one telling people that's when all the temperature drop happens. And sure enough, it did. It didn't really drop much more than that.
Sounds like it was much more dramatic where you were. I was in Buffalo, and most of it was blocked out, was eclipsed by the clouds, yeah. But I didn't get that red effect. It did seem sort of twilighty in 360 degrees of the horizon, which was interesting. There were 8 hawks circling around in the sky just before the eclipse started, and then they flew away from the sun later. I was wondering if that was because of the temperature drop affecting the winds, or if birds just get freaked out by the eclipse. Do you have any ideas?
I'm not an expert on the matter, but my guess is that they freaked out is probably the better way of going. They probably were confused anyways. They probably didn't know figured it was evening. So they were like, it's time to roost. And then just as they were getting to roost, the light comes back. Now, I heard birds fluttering around too. not that many, but I did hear some when we were in Rochester. I guess the good news with us, we missed all the horrible traffic jams, but they, I guess the Northway was a really bad gridlock road more than the thruway, because people who waited last minute headed towards northeastern New York and into New England and Vermont, where it was much, much clearer. The sky was much, much clearer. And of course, it was gorgeous the day before and the day after the eclipse. But you know what? Timing's everything. And it just wasn't, didn't happen. I've been lucky enough to see two eclipses without clouds in my life, total solar eclipses. So I guess I consider myself blessed. But the providence, to see those, that providence, that red providence, you know, with a total, that would have been cool to see. By the way, there was very few, if any, reports of anyone seeing the comet, the Devil's Comet.
And I'm interested in the red tinge that you mentioned earlier. Do you know what might have caused it?
Probably refraction of the light. You know, basically, when you have an eclipse, you get kind of a reddish glow. I've seen millions of pictures with this. You get the deep blue sky overhead, but you get that reddish glow. And what Bria said, the umbra never completely covers the horizon, because you can see more than 100 miles, or not, you can't see, but the light refracts around that. So it's a refraction of the red light, which is bent the most, I think. And I'm pretty sure that's what happened with the clouds in my situation. It's interesting that Bria had a different, it didn't seem like it got as dark. That's interesting, because Buffalo was right in the center line of the eclipse as well. Both Buffalo and Rochester were.
Another effect was my sister and her friend and I were talking about how the air felt different. It felt, I don't know, soft or something. Did you notice that?
I don't know, that's soft, but you're definitely, you know, the slight coolness and temperature. I think I remember smelling something weird, but that could have been because we were kind of in an industrial part of Rochester. But I do remember smelling something weird in the air. So there was some differences, and I guess I noticed that too in the other two eclipses as well. Just it is amazing all the things that change. It's just, which makes it so fascinating for 3 to 4 minutes of time, which of course, as you know, went very quickly, very, very quickly.
And moving from the eclipse, in past episodes, we've talked about the effect of El Nino on weather. And I understand mm-hmm. you have an update on that.
Yeah, well, it looks like the El Nino is definitely, it's not gone yet, but it's definitely weakening. And it's like an 80% chance it'll weaken in the next couple of weeks. And I'll tell you, boy, we've really had a wet spring because of the El Nino. It didn't happen last Super El Nino for some reason, but for every other Super El Nino, usually a wet spring follows, and we've had 14.63 inches of rain at the airport through April 15th, our third wettest from January 1st to April 15th of any year since 1874. 1990 was the last year that was wetter than at this time than that. We've had plenty of rain, but the El Nino effects will probably linger, although it's interesting. It looks like there is a subtle pattern change happening that might be coincidental with the weakening of the El Nino. It looks like we're going to start getting into a more northwesterly flow over the next week to 2 weeks. And for once, we don't see any big, big rainstorms our way. We'll still get disturbances, plenty of them, but we'll be looking at lighter precipitation amounts, which is a good thing because the water tables are high. I know we didn't get a lot of snow this winter, but the mountains sure did. And all that water runs down through the Hudson into the greater capital region. And the ground is saturated. So we do not need rain at this point. We really could use a break.
And speaking of precipitation and rain, early Monday morning, Albany had really thick fog. And I usually think of that as coming with the snow rising up and changing to mist. What's going on with the fog?
Well, it's a little unusual to get fog this time of year, but again, we've been having so much rain, the ground has been wet, and we just got under a classic inversion this morning. It, you know, had nothing to do with snow. It just basically had to do with the temperature and the dew point, which we talked about, were equal not only at the surface, but a long way from the surface up to probably a couple thousand feet off the deck. So, and you had the perfect conditions for fog to form. And then it took a while to dissipate. And then the guy was calm. And then I went out biking and the wind picked up. So it was kind of an interesting day. But that's a little unusual for April. Usually it's just not this wet in April. In April, we're talking about fire weather concerns, which I don't think we'll have to worry about at least this week. And by next week, we might be starting to have green up a little bit more. But we'll see how that goes. But anyway, the fog was interesting. It was one of the densest fog I've seen in a while this time of year. Absolutely.
And he, what do you think the weather has in store for us this coming week?
Okay, so basically this northwesterly flow was going to block the next system from coming in at least till Thursday. It looks like we will get a little rain Thursday night into Friday, but with any luck at all, it will get out of here for the weekend. Of course, this weekend is Earth Day weekend coming up with all the festivities from Saturday, Sunday, and Monday. And right now, fingers crossed, it looks pretty dry. There could be a few sprinkles around. It's not going to be warm with the northwesterly flow. It's actually going to be at or maybe slightly below seasonable temperatures, but their seasonable temperatures are now near 60, so I think we can all live with that. So it looks like a pretty good week coming up. A little bit of rain, like I said, Thursday into Thursday night, into early Friday, and then hopefully that's about it. And we won't be deluged this week like we have been the last many weeks.
Okay, thanks to you for joining us once again. We look forward to talking with you next week.
My pleasure. Take care. Have a good evening, everyone.
Thanks, you.
You too.
All right.
Now we shift to media issues. In March, our roaming labor correspondent, Willie Terry, attended the 2024 New York State Conference of the Puerto Rican and Hispanic Task Force of New York State Assembly and Senate. In this final report from the conference, Willie presents excerpts from a workshop on the importance of diversity in media.
Can you, I know we're also, of course, talking about Senator Hoylman Siegel's bill, and you've mentioned it a few times. Can you talk a little bit more about it and how it helps local outlets move into the future?
So the bill, looking forward, is based on, we see that there's a we need five years across the industry, from the community level on up to the daily level, to buy some time to help people adjust to the digital future, which we've been dealing with since 2008, and it just gets worse and worse. The hedge funds, which when they first appeared on the scene, there's a great book that's just out recently called Hedged that talks about just the appearance of the hedge funds, what that did to the old line media companies like McClatchy and Knight Ridder, which don't exist in their old forms, but to keep profits high, to hold off the hedge funds so they could keep their stockholders happy, they stopped their investments in the digital future. So they slowed the transitional, and they've been caught. Probably don't know this, but there are only two major publishers who still run printing presses in New York State. The New York Times out of College Point prints Newsday, the New York Times and other papers, and the Times Union here in Albany, which publishes all our sister publications in Connecticut, and then as well as the Kingston paper, the Troy paper, the Saratoga Springs paper, and a bunch of weeklies, plus the Times Union. I think we have 14 titles, daily titles that we're printing. The Buffalo News, which has always been a great paper in the far western part of the state, is printed in Cleveland now. The Syracuse paper, when it appears, it only prints 3 days a week, is printed in Harrisburg. Judy's old employer, the Gazette in Schenectady, is now printed in Springfield, Massachusetts, which is where the Wall Street Journal and the New York Post are printed. So it gives you an idea. I mean, the part of the decline in employment has been in our back shops, what we call the mechanicals. They're gone. I mean,
printing and distribution.
Printing and distribution. Drivers, yeah. I mean, we still have a mailroom because of the number of titles we're printing. The mailroom is where the papers go through and are packaged. It's actually a craft, and it comes back from when most daily papers were actually mailed if they weren't distributed on newsstands. I mean, it's very hard. You can't, there are only a few places here in Albany, Stewart's and the grocery stores. Those are the places you buy daily newspapers. I used to go down to newsstands, Colson's, just down the street here on Broadway and State to buy the Philadelphia Inquirer. You can't get it anymore, because I have lived and worked in Philadelphia. So our bill is to provide tax credits, sponsored by Senator Hoylman Siegel and Carrie Warner, the assembly member. I think she's your assembly member, isn't she? From up in Saratoga and Washington counties. It's based on the national bill that died because of split in the House of Representatives and the Senate there. And the guild, the word was they sent out is, we started looking for places where we could act at the state level New York and California and Illinois is where those battles are happening and pushing forward. And what's in the pipeline is also a bill to take on the, it's being drafted to take on the major tech companies because of what they've sucked out of the advertising out of the business. Mm-hmm. It will be based on successes in Australia and Canada, where, you know, it gets down to negotiating payments to papers. But our bill would affect everybody, all the publications, plus radio, TV, and legitimate digital sites by providing underwriting. Okay, we've spent $50,000. My top scale, because we're under imposed conditions, is $52,000. And, you know, I make a couple of thousand dollars more than that a year. So practically half of my salary would be covered by that. The idea would be that the publishers hopefully would use it not to cut their editorial staffs anymore, mm-hmm. and this is what we're pushing, is to expand it, use that money to expand it, to buy it, because when you have reporters, photographers, and editors working, it gives people will buy something. They have something they can see both online and in print. The print circulations are dismal. I mean, we just saw the latest numbers from a year ago. There were three large papers across the country that had circulation declines of less than 10%. Everyone else was 10 to 20%. The New York Times was down around, is over 10% decline. Mm-hmm. I think the Daily News was down to the Wall Street Journal. These were all the major papers. I know the situation isn't any better in Albany. I have an idea what the numbers are, but I'm a little out of date on them because it doesn't impact me like it does the mailroom. I mean, to give you an idea, I have discussions with my counterpart who runs the Teamsters local that represents our mailroom employees. And they used to have like 80 employees. They're down to like 20 to 25 regular situation holders. And they're saying, do we have 5 years left? I said, I think you might have 10, but we don't know. And that's why this bill is, because if we can get the tax credits for what we call the mission, it's going to keep the rest of our people working, and it's going to keep the public informed about what's going on. You know, we have to pick and choose right now. In a lot of ways, like Harvey, at that level, you're going to know more about what's going on, because that's the community you're covering. The community I'm covering is a county, and it's a regional. The Times, to show you how bad things have gotten, the Times Union has expanded its footprint down to Westchester County, mm-hmm. digitally, because the papers, the daily papers down there have shrunk to one and zero people
covering.
And, you know, I mean, I grew up essentially, you know, all over the state, but my father currently lives in Western Suffolk. So we go home, we always look at the Long Islander, which was Walt Whitman, the poets, that's his old paper. And I look at the Eastwood Press out in Rensselaer County. There is no real weekly in the city of Albany. There's some sites online, but our bill, again, it's, we're trying to buy a 5-year window to help people further adapt so they're not pressured by the declining revenues, and that they have some money they can invest in. And I know from talking to like Josh Schnepps, like, mm-hmm. down in Queens, mm-hmm. whose family runs a chain of weeklies, and actually got going with the old Willowbrook. Mm-hmm. That's how his mom got involved, with Gerardo Rivera interviewing her. You know, as Josh says, it would benefit them. You know, he sees it, he's worked with us. We had a lobby day a week ago, 2 weeks ago, and Josh was there.
Yeah.
Actually got in to see the Speaker of the Assembly, which we were overwhelmed.
I have to say, and of course I'm biased, in Queens we have many weeklies. We have the Queens Eagle, the Queens Chronicle, the Queens Courier. You know, we're very lucky. And of course the Queens Latino, which was very needed.
Well, I always say, I know there's a Queens Herald. There's a Herald chain, and that's my, because I'm not in there, but I know that. You know, Queens is a very vibrant, but that reflects the vibrancy of the borough itself and the diversity. But, you know, it goes. You know, it's important to have the daily papers, the weekly papers.
Absolutely.
you know, keeping an eye on elected officials and governments. I probably have been at the same sewer commissions as Judy was.
Yeah, no, absolutely. We're going to put a pin there because I know we've had a very robust conversation, right? We have amazing panelists. And hopefully we've given you some food for thought. And
I'm here with Senator Jessica Ramos, who just had a workshop on diversity in the media. How you doing, Jonathan? Right.
Really thankful for you today, actually, in having this conversation, because we need more labor reporters, we need more black reporters, and what we were talking about was really how we can diversify our newsrooms, what role government should be playing in supporting that effort and making sure that we're better connecting with our communities, because local and ethnic media, community media, is where most people get their information from, which is, you know, busting the myth that mainstream media is the only type of media that matters, when many times we know that who's behind, in terms of money, behind that media has their own agenda, and why we need to keep supporting a local journalist such as yourself.
Now, what do you think, as you being a senator, you could do to aid in that process?
Well, right now, we are promoting my bill in order to have state government make better investments in local and community media by sponsoring PSAs about all of the different services and programs that we're offering. I can't tell you how much money we end up allocating to a lot of these programs, but people out in the street just don't know about them. And at the same time, we know that local and community media sometimes struggles in order to remain afloat. So we want to kill both of those birds with one stone and make sure that the state government is investing at least 50% of its media buys in local media to support those outlets, but also to make sure that people, grassroots people, are getting the information they need.
I'm so sorry, I got to take her.
All right. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you. Thank you for coming.
Besides New York Senator Jessica Ramos, we also heard from the New York Press Association's Ken Crow, president of the Albany Newspaper Guild. Thanks to Willie Terry for his coverage of the SOMOS Conference of the Puerto Rican and Hispanic Task Force of the New York State Assembly and Senate. For Willie's four earlier reports from the conference, visit mediasanctuary.org.
For our final story, Marsha Lazarus brings us part two of her conversation with the well-known social justice advocate, Dr. Alice Padden Green, about many topics, including her vision of a truly inclusive society and the current project she's working on.
Women Read Book Club was started 25 years ago by longtime Capital Region resident and friend, Deborah Johnson. Deborah's vision was, and still is, to enlarge our lives by reading books authored by women from diverse backgrounds. As a member for 22 years, my life has been greatly enriched by the books we read and our thought-provoking two-hour discussions. Every once in a while, we're treated with a visit by the author of the book that we read that month. This past December, we had that opportunity when we read We Who Believe in Freedom by well-known criminal justice advocate Alice Padden Green. Alice's sharing at our meeting added so much. So when Deborah Johnson let us all know that Alice Green would be talking last month about her second memoir, Outsider, at the Writers Institute presentation at Albany Public Library, I knew I wanted to hear more. Welcome to Hudson Mohawk Magazine. Marsha Lazarus, sitting with Dr. Alice Padden Green. Thank you so much, Alice, for accepting my invitation for this interview and the opportunity to learn more. Alice, I understand that in July 2021, you were inducted into the Essex Literary Wall of Fame at the Belden Noble Library in Essex, New York. That sounds like quite an honor. You know, I know you talked in the book about when you were a young girl wanting so much to be seen and appreciated for your abilities and as an equal human being. And I wondered if that recognition and all of your accomplishments, if that has made you, if you have felt more seen and recognized by the community up in the Adirondacks or your old friends or neighbors.
I'm sure, you know, people I grew up with, they probably heard about me because some of them do contact me when they, like, say a book comes out, they'll say, oh my gosh, thank you for writing that book, or I remember you, or something like that. So I have had that, but I get my awards and rewards from from other places. Like yesterday, when I was with the students at Northern Rivers, you know, we had just the greatest conversation about writing, and I'm trying to inspire them to write. These are troubled kids, you know. And as I was getting ready to leave after the session, this young girl came up to me and she handed me this piece of paper, folded over and opened it up. She said the nicest things about, I'm so glad you came and shared your experiences with us. And I'm inspired to write and I hope you come back again. It's been so wonderful to have you here and all that kind of stuff, you know. This is really touching. Those are the kind of awards that I probably appreciate more than the others. You know, I mean, I'm appreciative. I've gotten a number of them, but it's the ones that like that that are very special to me. You know, I feel like it really comes from the heart. You just.
I was struck by your comment in the book at the funeral parlor.
I think that was when my dad died.
And I heard so much pride in your words. It is the history of a remarkable family whose members had struggled to be recognized as an integral part of a community that was not always welcoming. Do you feel that your accomplishments, the fact that you have been recognized, brings recognition to your parents and your family?
That's a difficult one because I wish my parents could have been around longer. I wish, always wish they could see what has happened with their children. I think they would be really proud. As I said, we were a close-knit family and we suffered together. and then we were able to, because of that closeness and support, we were all able to go our own ways, but you know, accomplished, I think, remarkable things. Like my brother Ralph, you know, has a stadium named after him down in D.C., Maryland area, because he was, I can't believe how well received he was and how people looked up to him, and he was just incredible. He was a football coach and very recognized for his work with kids. You know, not just that he was a good coach, but he really gave a lot to his kids off the, you know, off the field, and they had such respect for him. So we all did pretty much what we would consider successful in whatever we took on, and I think that's what they struggled for. I wish they could have seen how we all turned out.
The fruits of their labor.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. So,
wow.
So I think about them all the time. They were the rock. You know, and so, and poverty, we experienced poverty, but
not poverty of love.
Not of love at all. So that's the thing I'm most thankful for.
You know, you talk about there's been much done to fight racial discrimination in the Adirondacks, but you question whether people have really get the definition or the meaning of true inclusion. You talk about oftentimes it's a numbers game and it's not real inclusion. Mm-hmm. What does true inclusion look like in a community, in a society?
Yeah, it's really very simple, but difficult to achieve. I believe that until we can repair the damage that's been done. For instance, the way we talk about slavery, we say, oh, people were enslaved at the end of 1865. Now you got civil rights and all of that. But they don't understand the true impact it has on your psyche, your thinking. I was socialized to believe that whites were superior to me.
Was there a particular experience, or was it moving away from Witherby that helped you kind of dismantle that belief or buy into it?
Oh, it's something that you constantly have to deal with. I mean, I've been able to overcome much of it. I do believe I am equal, but probably not the way that I would have hoped, because it's been so ingrained in me, and it happens every day. If it doesn't happen to me personally, it happens to somebody else. But there are so many ways that we can heal and repair. We're developing a project now to try to do that. Brian Stevenson has a great way of doing it. He said you got to experience it in some way so that you can understand. The one thing that happened, I don't know if you caught it, I did, at the library, was somebody asked me about the trunk, because I explained that the trunk was, you know, our lifeline almost, and how important it was in my family. And then when my parents died, it was so depressing to me that I just sort of left everything, and the trunk got destroyed. And when I said that, I heard people say, they gasped. They said, oh my gosh. They were feeling. To me, that was so important, you know, for you to connect with something and feel and be able to feel it. Lynching was not just lynching. It was destroying people, and not only the person who was lynched, but their families.
And it was a celebratory occasion.
Right,
for
exactly.
Whites together.
Exactly. They had picnics there, and police officers, law enforcement helped. It was horrible. And so what I'm trying to get people to do is to feel that. I might take, you know, different pieces from different films. I have about six films that focus on the kidnapping, Middle Passage, and also the words from people who actually were enslaved. So I wanted to put, you know, different pieces together. It could be filmed, and it's having community discussions. So I'm trying to dig deep into people and say, you got to feel. Because if you can't feel for me, you can't accept me. I want people to feel the way I felt about the Jewish Holocaust. When I see people being put on trains and taken to be killed, you know, it hurts me deep. I can feel it.
Yeah. Okay. So feel, you're talking about feeling in order to take action, really.
Exactly. Right. And to accept feeling and to understand who I am.
Marcia Lazarus talking with Dr. Alice Payden Green.
Other excerpts of Marcia's conversation with Dr. Alice Green are available at mediasanctuary.org.
And that's our show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Lennox Aputo. Our engineer is the incredible Sina Basilayeki.
And I'm Bria Barthel. Other volunteers who made today's episode possible include Mark Dunley, Willie Terry, Marcia Lazarus, and Hugh Johnson. And thanks to you, our listeners, including our favorite live streamer in Kenya, for making this all worthwhile.